Mics are live.
Good morning, everyone. It is Thursday, July 11th, 9:04. This is a public information exchange meeting with Montana Dakota Utilities Group and the North Dakota Public Service Commission. I'm Commissioner Brian Crotius, joined by Commissioner Julie Fedorchuk and Commissioner Randy Christman. And I don't know how formal we... I know we don't get terribly formal. No. Do we have the company representatives at the table introduce themselves? How have we done that in the past?
Doesn't hurt.
You're right, it doesn't hurt. Why don't
it's sometimes helpful for the rest of the room.
Yeah. So why don't we just do that with the six of you? That'd be great.
Okay. Travis Jacobson, and I'm with Montana Dakota's Regulatory Department.
Darcy Nigam with Montana Dakota Utility System Operations and Planning Department.
Brian Giggy with Montana Dakota Utilities and System Operations and Planning Department.
And Nicole Cavisto with Montana Dakota Utilities, President and CEO.
Jay Scable, Vice President of Electric Supply.
Garrett Singer, Vice President of Regulatory.
All right, perfect. Well, thank you so much for being here. I don't have any opening comments beyond that.
I don't either.
Nor do I.
Okay, well, you've got a presentation. Look forward to...
Perfect.
Seen it.
All right, so thanks for taking the time and getting back together. Essentially, what we wanted to do today is just follow up from a couple PI meetings. We had a PI meeting in December, as you recall, and then back in February, we came and met with the commissioners on a one-on-one basis just ahead of our announcement on the retirements of Lewis and Clark and Heskett. So today, what we really wanted to focus on is ultimately, now we've filed that IRP with the state of North Dakota. What were the results of that IRP? And then dive into a little more details around our retirement analysis and how we got to that conclusion. So as a reminder, I know the commission and Montana Dakota share the same views, and that is to provide safe, reliable, and cost-effective service. And when it comes to our decision on the retirement, it really came down to an economic decision. And so dealing with that cost-effective component of our objective, safe, reliable, and cost-effective. And today we plan to share more details around that decision and get to the conclusion in terms of why we felt this was the most cost-effective for our customers. So you'll see that come out in the presentation. When you look at the agenda, if we just flip ahead to your slide, what you have in your hands, just turn it one page, you'll see what we want to cover here in more detail. And Brian and Darcy will go over the IRP and the results of the IRP, as well as additional plant retirement analysis that was done. That is filed as an exhibit as part of the IRP as well. And then Travis will talk about the revenue requirement and looking at the customer impacts of that retirement analysis. Jay will talk a little bit about physically the retirement of our coal fleet, as well as the employee impact and what we're doing there. And then Alan will come to the table and talk about the next generation resource, which we've identified in the IRP as a simple cycle unit at the Heskett station. We're calling Heskett Station Unit 4. And then Garrett will conclude with really what does this mean from a regulatory construct and what will you be seeing in the future. So we'll just probably go ahead and get started unless there's anything else that you wanted to add to the agenda or other thoughts you had in terms of the purpose of the meeting today. Okay, I think we'll dive right in then. Brian, I'll turn it over to you.
All right, thanks, Nicole. Good morning, commissioners. My first slide here will be just going over kind of what is the Integrated Resource Plan. It is a systematic process that looks at future supply-side resources and demand resources, and also looking at our existing units if there's any external environmental upgrades or anything that needs to be done on the plants. So that's kind of the high level of what the Integrated Resource Plan is. We file this every odd year on July 1st, which we just filed, as Nicole mentioned. The next bullet here is it is not a fluid. When we file the IRP, it's basically a point in time. This is where we're at right now. There's constantly changing. If we have different new generation that comes available that we need to look at, we can run the model to look at that, see if it's a more cost-effective. Also, just looking at if there's potential fuel price changes, different environmental rules, any other kind of changes, we can always go back and look at that model that we used in that, basically in our 2019 IRP.
How far ahead does it look?
It goes out 20 years is okay. How far we look out is what the modeling does. So.
And it lays out a resource plan for 20 years, or is it more like, is there a 5-year, 10-year look, or how is it broken down?
It solves for the full 20 years, but we basically look out maybe 5 years to really look. Anything above 5 years, it's kind of iffy. You don't know that's going to be the same, because you can go back and look at our previous IRPs and things have changed in just 2 years. So
And then we specifically state, just to add on to that, a 2-year action plan. So kind of more near term, what do these results tell us we need to do over the next 2 years? And he'll cover that.
This next slide just kind of a flow chart of how we do the integrated resource plan. We basically start with our load forecast, which is done in-house. We develop a base forecast, a high and low forecast, and then that goes into both the demand side and the supply side analysis. We also have our IRP public advisory group that we meet. We met 3 times this go around. They help give input either into the demand side management side or the supply side. And then we also, through those, we also have on our supply side, we go out and have a consultant develop kind of our future prices for future resources. And then we also went out for a request for proposal that was also included in the modeling this go around. So that was kind of the supply side. We didn't have any new demand side that was included in the model this time. We just had our existing interruptible and commercial demand, which is about 40 megawatts. And then with those combined, that produced our integrated resource plan.
So I see the box over here, social, economic, societal, governmental, and customer issues. How do you factor those in, and do you have any jurisdictions that are requiring you to look at certain levels of reductions in like CO2 or that type of thing?
I mean,
no,
we just
don't, but
we have the requirement in Montana for the
ARP. What is theirs?
Is it
15%? So, and we're far exceeding 15%.
Yeah.
So we don't have any governmental construct dictating our decision.
Okay.
I mean, is that fair, Darcy? You look like maybe you wanted to say.
Nope, that is fair. The only one that we've added in as well is just sort of through the sensitivity analysis we do. So we have a base case that really doesn't have any of those externalities that are included in the analysis. But in the past, we have run things even like carbon sensitivities, of putting carbon taxes and other things on.
Mm-hmm.
Not that we're required by any jurisdiction to do that, but we've included that just kind of as a sensitivity or case that would show if something would come along at a certain level, does that change what our resource plan would look like? So that's really probably the only large externality that we continue to conclude is at least a $30 per ton carbon credit. And Brian will talk a little bit more about those sensitivities.
This next slide, this was kind of the beginning of the MISO's planning year 1920. This was just looking at it when we first came out. So this would be our resource by zonal resource credits by resource type. And then it also includes our planning reserve margin requirement, which includes our 81.5% coincident factor that we have with MISO, so we don't have to carry the 100% load. And then it also includes the 7.9% planning reserve margin, which is that black line. So going into this, we were looking good till 2028. This does not include any retirements, nothing. This was just the beginning process. So it was showing that we were good out till 2028 with our zonal resource credits. This next slide here, this is kind of some of the inputs into the model. As I've already mentioned, we have the 20-year forecast with the 81.5% coincident factor. The model includes all of our existing generation fleet. It includes O&M and fuel cost for each of those units. It also has a MISO energy market built into the model, which is 200 megawatts for on-peak and off-peak that I can pick for energy instead of dispatching our own generation. It also has our existing demand response, the interruptible and commercial, and then the energy efficiency that we have is built into the load forecast, so it's reduced off the load forecast. like I mentioned before, includes future supply options that we went out to a third party to get pricing for that, and then it also included some of the RFP options that we got from our 2018 RFP. And then the unit retirements, we have Lewis and Clark.
Oh, were there any surprises in terms of looking out or the supply options? Did that anything jump out or surprise you in terms of how that's shifting or about what you expected?
I think so. I mean, some of the solar and stuff has come down in price, but for the most part, everything else has stayed pretty much the same as far as gas and turbines pricing.
Yeah, so I think some of the more traditional resources are still probably the same. You know, we do look in-house, you know, whether it's coal, gas, peaking combined cycle, you know, wind pricing and solar. We also added some storage prices in this time that we haven't done in the past. So trying to continue to look at what others are doing, trying to get more information on those types of resources and also be able to at least start to do the analysis pieces on things like storage and others, you know, and how might it be used and what sort of costs would come with those. So, but not really a lot of surprises. You know, the RFP certainly was probably more surprising just because there's certainly continues to be a large amount of development speculation, large solar and large wind that's out there. And a lot of those weren't very near term. They were more out there, you know, 4 or 5 years that still had a lot of unknown costs, largely driven by, you know, potential network upgrade costs for interconnections. Because the majority of the RFP responses did not have signed generator interconnections, and so it's always the unknown when they go through the MISO queue process, what are they going to be assigned for costs? Because they want to pass those along to us is pretty much standard now on all of those.
Would you say you limit the MISO market energy purchases to 20%?
200 megawatts.
200 megawatts for
it's
capacity?
Capacity, it's limited to 20 megawatts per year. It can pick for capacity. Energy, it's 200 megawatts, so it can be dispatched instead of, say, one of our combustion turbines and stuff.
Is there a reason to put the limitation? So
we've had those limitations in the past, and I think if we go back 10 years, that limitation was more like 50 megawatts, because a lot of that we end up using that number because it helps us reflect back to the actual generation levels we end up seeing at least our coal plants and our gas turbines run at. If we'd end up using too small of a value for MISO energy, we see our gas turbines generate pretty much a significant amount of potential energy, which they don't in the actual year. And if you turn around the other way, if you open it up too wide, you know, at least the pricing on that doesn't follow the cyclical values you might see through the interday. It's more of an average that you end up having at least on-peak and off-peak. So we get a better reflection at least what our coal plant capacity factors are in doing that.
So it's more so a tweak to make the model run a little bit more like reality as in the past.
Correct.
Victor. I mean, you'll have questions. Grab the mic.
All right. The next one is the unit retirements. It's labeled here 2020 and 2021 for the units. In the model, we actually retired all the units in 2021 instead of staggering them. And then the other unit retirements we do in the model is all of our wind are retired at 25 years. Kind of the reason behind that is the model solves for the 20 years, but then it goes an additional 30 years to use up any capital if any new units are picked. So instead of letting the wind run for another 50 years, we retired it off at 25 years. So it's not running for the full 50 years, and it has to be replaced before the end of the 20 years.
Is that more from a bookkeeping standpoint versus reality, though? I mean, you don't really expect that they'll be shut down in 25 years, do you?
So generally,
is that repowering phase at that point in time?
You would be into that repowering phase. So what additional capital might be required and how many more years you're expecting? You'd have to do that analysis later. But the big piece Brian is getting into is if you don't retire those wind resources off, for that remaining 30 years of economic analysis, it basically assumes that those units are still there and they're really at a zero cost at that point. because they're fully depreciated, and you're saying there's no additional capital, there's really very little for O&M and other things.
Right.
And so it's something that we've done for a couple IRPs now, saying, you know, we want to see the impact of retiring those off so we're not somehow misstating what our future costs should be, and we end up knowing that those resources have to be replaced with something at some point.
It's not from an operational as much as just accurately reflecting future costs.
The accuracy, yep.
They're depreciated out, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And now into some of the outputs from the modeling. We'll have our base case, and then I'll just kind of run through the sensitivities. I'll talk more about the results after Darcy talks about some of the retirement analysis. But we have the low and high growth scenarios. We have a low gas scenario, which was a dollar below what the base case was, which was about average of $3 starting out in 2019. And then we did two high natural gas prices, one at $2 and one at $5 over the base case. And then we did a low and high market price, which the low was $3 from the base year, and then the high was $5 and $10 over the base year. Then we do a high CT cost, which just basically adds a 20% adder to all future combustion turbines, combined cycles, any kind of natural gas-fired unit. Then we did a 90% MISO coincident factor instead of the 81.5%. Then, as Darcy mentioned, we did do the $30 carbon tax sensitivity. And then the last case here was just a high MISO energy price and high gas price, which the market was $25 higher and the natural gas was $5 higher than the base case. It's just kind of a worst case scenario, and just to see what, if the model would pick something different versus what the base case was picking. So, and here's my last slide before I turn it over to Darcy here. This one basically is the same as the first chart. This one just includes our retirements now. It would be Lewis and Clark 1, Heskett 1, and Heskett 2, plus all the wind out in the later years, just showing that decrease in the zonal resource credits that we have. So with those retirements, it's showing that we are good through 2021 now instead of 2028. And with that, the Lewis and Clark is about 41 megawatts, or ZRCs, so when it retires at the end of 2020, we'd still be good in 2021, because the model has it retiring in 2021, but we would still be good with that Lewis and Clark retirement.
Can you remind me what this zonal resource credits is? It's been a while since I've heard that term.
Yep. It's basically all of our generation has, or at least our coal-fired and gas-fired test every year. Then they have a forced outage rate, and then that test value is reduced by whatever that forced outage rate is.
It's basically okay. The capacity factor per se, Julie, of that unit. So,
and is this a MISO thing?
Yep.
Yes. MISO evaluates you, and this is your capacity credit, basically?
Yes.
Yep.
So you're not going to get, you know, for wind, you're going to get less than you would for,
right.
Yes.
So this chart shows, the stacks show what your zonal resource credits are?
Yep, or per resource.
Black line.
The black line, that's our requirement. That's the planning reserve.
Short.
Yep.
Short.
Yep.
I thought you said you were good through 2028. I don't see that.
That was that original chart. That was before we did any.
Okay.
This includes the retirements in there. Before, that didn't include any retirements.
Okay.
So this doesn't include any additional resources like Heskett 4.
I see.
Yep.
I got it now.
Yep.
Thank you.
Yep.
So this basically speaks to the need after you retire of bringing something new on.
Right. Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
But does not account for Heskett 4.
This chart does not. No.
Correct.
Correct.
So what the chart would represent is basically when we go into the resource plan, this is what the model is trying to solve. We would have this deficit to make up for capacity, plus then also the economic dispatch to find out what ends up being the least cost plan.
So on the renewables in this stack, the what's the nameplate capacity versus what you're getting credit for at MISO?
We have 200 megawatts of wind, and we get about 20% of that from our wind farm.
Right. And that's Thunder Spirit?
Here at Diamond Willow and Cedar Hills.
Oh, okay.
That's about 50. We get more than what the MISO average does. The MISO average is about 15.7% this year. We get a little about 20% if you average the three together.
Okay.
Are Diamond Willow, this was before my time, and Cedar Hills, are they in Montana or both Montana and North
Dakota? Diamond Willow is in Montana and Cedar Hills is in North Dakota.
Okay, so they're, okay.
Does this get averaged out for MISO purposes, or do they have different capacity factors, is the right term for what you get credit for?
Yep, each unit, after it gets so much history, after 3 years of history, then it gets its own capacity factor, whatever it has at the MISO peaks.
So I'm presuming, just based on, you know, hopefully we're getting better at things, that Thunder Spirit has the highest, and then the smaller, older two are probably less?
Right now, actually, Cedar Hills is our best, and then it's Diamond Willow, then it's Thunder Spirit, but we still don't have a lot of history for Thunder Spirit, so since it's newer. So once it gets more history, it should be up there, if not the highest that we have.
Before they have history, is it just something that MISO assigns based on...
Yep, they calculate...
theirs?
Yep, they calculate an average, which is that 15.7%.
And then as you develop history, that replaces the estimates.
Yep, yep.
But if you look at our capacity factors for the generation, isn't it fair to say that Thunder Spirit's higher than the other two? So to your point, on an actual basis, it is higher, Randy. It's just we're not getting that credit yet in MISO. So,
how does your level of confidence, let's see, you're the boss. I'm going to put you on the spot. I figured that out a long time ago.
Yeah.
What is your level of confidence today in these projections and the supply side assumptions, the amount of renewables coming online, societal pressure, state policy changes, compared to even 5 years ago? I mean, it just has to be maddening trying to, maybe not maddening, but... how confident do you feel after you put all these numbers together?
I feel pretty confident because, I mean, we run through each of the sensitivities, and when I go through those results, you'll see that it's picking pretty much through each sensitivity the same thing. So, I mean, changing different things, I mean, it's still picking the exact same thing. Mm-hmm. So it's pretty confident that it's picking the right resources. Yep.
Yeah, it's just changed so much versus even a decade ago, 10 years ago.
Yep.
It was more of a steady eddy type in terms of assumptions, at least it would seem to me that was the case.
Yep.
In comparison to today. Okay.
So I think that's a good segue into, as we talk about at least more of the unit retirements, because part of this also talks about how some of those assumptions, at least on gas prices and market energy prices, have changed, at least over our last four integrated resource plans. So that's really what I wanted to share now, is more of those details on at least the reasons and the decisions why we ended up having the retirement date set at the end of 2020 for Lewis and Clark and the end of 2021 for Heskett Station. And then Travis is also going to go into more of a review of more of a separate from what Brian does for modeling. We'll also go separately into a revenue requirement modeling, as Nicole said, which looks at what's the customer impact, at least as it pertains to, you know, that retirement, you know, and the replacement with a combustion turbine, you know, and also with market purchases, and then also looking at, you know, the aspects or impacts, at least, of any remaining capital that we have still invested in those plans. So that's kind of what we're going to segue into a little bit, is more of those detailed pieces. So when we look at retirement dates, at least for units, it isn't something new, not something new that we've done under integrated resource plans. We've included retirement dates for units back as early as 2013. You know, the first one dealt with the Lewis and Clark Station, where we had an environmental upgrade, which was for the mercury and air toxic standard, that we had to make some upgrades for that. And so we actually, at that point in that resource plan, allowed that plant to be retired, said it was retired, and let the model basically select it back at its current operating cost, O&M, and looking at what I had for fuel costs, but said you have to pick this additional capital investment. And then we ran it over a shorter time period. So you could pick it, but it would only last for 5 years. And so when we did that, that model then did justify at least the mercury and air toxic standard upgrades that we did make on that unit that went online in 2015. We also included a retirement date for Heskett 1 at the end of 2019 because it was our oldest and really least efficient coal plant we had, and said at some point something else is going to come for it at some point in the future for capital additions. But we wanted to start thinking about with our model of how do we start looking for future retirements. We get into 2015 and we included those, you know, additional future retirement dates for Heskett 1, Lewis and Clark. A lot of that was looking at potential EPA rules that were coming, you know, including greenhouse gas, and looking at sort of those same things. Something is going to come in the future. We're going to have to do this analysis at some point, and it helped us plan. So we have the two-year action plan, but we also would know looking out 5-10 years, should we be looking at something, which was combined cycle, at least something potentially to replace it. So it told us to go look at those sorts of things. We could also do some of the engineering and study. So when we came to what we thought was this resource plan in 2019 to look at the replacement with a combined cycle, we would have better information to actually put that together, not in a five-year action plan, but move it up into that two-year sort of action plan slot. So 2017, we also included Heskett 2 now, at least in that retirement analysis. And one of the big things that was driving that was really into the clean power plan and also something like regional haze or something else that was going to come impacting all of those units. And really when we looked at the clean power plan back in 2017, if you remember, there was an initial plan and then kind of the final rule where we all kind of thought the initial plan we were good on making the reductions because it was more by state, and then we ended up everybody had to meet those same reduction levels. And when we got to those reduction levels, and that final rule at that time, the only way we were going to be able to meet those requirements was really by retiring those three units off. It was the only way to do it. So we included that out there in 2024, included Heskett 2. We had the 2024 date as well because we thought we had to continue to run those units to that point date really to get those credits and reductions of carbon, if that would have been what would have been, you know, the clean power plan or what would have been a place for carbon reductions. And so in doing that, we continued to have retirement dates for the units. Again, it was driven by something in the future or knowing what was going on around us that was driving those dates. And it was letting us put together plans of what to study and look at. So as I mentioned, when we got into the 2019 Integrated Resource Plan, we're still looking at this 2024 dates for all three of those units. And in that, in order to justify if those were the right dates or not, we went out for this request for proposals that were supposed to support that analysis. We issued that in August of last year. You know, the capacity we were looking for, and it wasn't specific on anything. It was just an all resource capacity and energy, looking for something between 10 and 250 megawatts. You know, 10, we didn't want to get into a bunch of 1 and 2 megawatt contracts because we know economies of scale, they aren't, you know, large enough to at least make something that's economic. The 250, we wanted to make sure that we would cover the maximum potential of what that combined cycle addition would end up being if we would build that project out. And we did let people know in that request for proposal that we'd be evaluating those bids against a company combined cycle plant that we were looking to potentially construct.
So, Darcy, just to clarify, mm-hmm. when did the clean power plan and some of that stuff drop off as the assumption that drove the retirement? Because it sounds like that was initially kind of what drove the retirement dates, but that's, I mean, that is gone for now, at least.
Sure, and so that's a good point, because that's when we talk about when we went through this RFP and we're still looking at what is the next resource we should be looking at, what we ended up seeing is that combined cycle plant was no longer economic. So it made us turn around and look back at what should be the appropriate retirement dates for these units,
okay.
especially with the when the clean power plan was vacated.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what kind of gave us this clean look to go and look at that. But I pointed out 2024 because that's why we had a date that was out there, and we've talked about 2024, is at least we wanted to make sure that we were aware of what may come for carbon, also may come for future CapEx, but also knew we had to ultimately justify what those final retirement dates were.
So maybe just saying it another way, Julie, is in 2017, the assumption was really predicated around environmental regulation, yep. Clean power plan. 2019, it's really predicated around economics.
Okay.
And you'll see the shift. They'll talk about the economics here in a minute.
Yeah.
So in that request for proposal, we did get 20 proposals that were received. This ends up kind of being the breakdown just by resource type. So the 6 wind, 3 solars, you can kind of go through the rest of those. Some of these projects were actually very, very large, like 350 megawatts in size that we ended up having. And so we had a very robust list, at least of alternatives to look at. The one thing I commented before, virtually all of these did not have final interconnection costs. And so there was that unknown of signing something up. So we did not shortlist any of these, but as Brian said, we did include them in the analysis. And so part of that, as it was chosen, we see a few of these that are in kind of the outlying years. So it doesn't say put these in 2020. It says look at 2022 or something, which is telling us to continue to go out and look potentially if these are still economic when we get out, at least in the next integrated resource plan.
Can you talk about where the distributed solar, the geography? Or if you can't, you can't. But I'm curious, where would that, generally speaking, have been located?
So this would have been from a developer that was trying to do something a little bit novel and different, that they would come in and rather than be interconnecting on our MISO transmission facilities, mm-hmm. they would, in a sense, would want to interconnect at the lower voltage and really avoid those interconnection costs, because
mm-hmm.
you're really doing something that is what you'd call behind the meter.
Right, right.
Yep. And so there was a cost, at least, on a dollars per megawatt hour for those. They tend to be smaller in size. At least so from the economics, they're not as competitive as something that's larger as project size. And it would basically say they were looking to aggregate, if it was 50, 100 megawatts, they wanted something that was in like 20 megawatt blocks or something they were looking at putting on our system.
Okay.
And who is they?
But from a geography standpoint, though?
It could be anywhere. So they would work with us to find whatever the best places may be and where we had suitable interconnections.
And again, asking is, were they targeting the Bismarck-Mandan area? Were they targeting another?
It wasn't specific.
It wasn't.
On the distributed solar.
On
these other solars, there was some.
Right.
Yep.
Yeah.
That's what you're asking?
No, on the distributed.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I'm just, because as you mentioned, it's behind the meter, and so now we're getting into rooftop, et cetera.
It would have been more like community solar, I would call it, instead of rooftop.
Oh, okay.
So you'd have something on the edge of town if it's Bismarck,
sure.
And
it
would have allowed us to come back if we do those, to come back and do some other
sorts of
community solar garden type stuff. But
all right.
Okay. And was there a certain company, is it an out-of-state developer that was looking at that sort of thing?
I don't know if you remember which one they were.
Do we still have
So we have an NDA on the pricing that would have lasted 2 years, but the name of it is one of the larger developers.
Okay.
With that,
you can't say. It's fine.
I'm not sure.
Curiosity. I'm always curious who's kind of circling around on these stuff.
Yeah, I think it was EDF Renewables is the one that was. So as I mentioned before, when we talk about the IRP analysis, it was no longer selecting that combined cycle. So that was kind of the initial analysis we were doing when we ended up having the RFPs and we ended up having the updated combined cycle costs was going and running some of our initial screening models. One of the reasons it wasn't picking that combined cycle anymore, and it gets back to these assumptions as they change, at least the capital cost for that project was coming in a little higher. As you do more detailed engineering analysis, you find out more things you have to do and you get better pricing. Also, the forecast for natural gas and MISO energy and at least other alternatives through the RFP were coming down. So a lot of times you want to build combined cycle or something. If it's coal, you're thinking all the other alternatives are at a higher cost.
Sure.
Now, if those costs become less and less, there isn't really the economic benefit of building something big and large and that's efficient because everything else has become less expensive for the alternatives. And we end up seeing instead of the combined cycle that the model picks among some of the other future resources, at least, is the 88-megawatt simple cycle combustion turbine at Heskett And the plus in the future are things like other natural gas resources, renewables, and we're starting to see battery storage in some cases that's coming in.
Did any of the model, when you ran any of the assumptions, I think you've already answered this, but when it was like high gas price and a high MISO energy price, it still didn't pick the combined cycle unit?
It still did not.
Wow. I just wonder if, 10 years from now, we're going to regret putting in all these peakers and not having some of the more efficient units on.
Yeah, so one of the things, that was the reason we looked at the combined cycle, was worrying about so many peakers.
Right.
And again, we were into gas prices that are $4 and $5 and energy prices that were $30 and up, and it started to make sense to look at it that way. We just end up, when we look at Heskett 4, one of the things we're doing is that site is laid out and has the potential to combine cycle. It's still in the future.
Yeah.
So we're taking all of those things into account. If something changes, it's not a no-regret situation. We can come back in. It's just that final piece is the most expensive part.
Right.
Yep.
Wasn't Heskett designed to take on two more units?
It was really sized to take on.
Or just one more?
Just one more.
One more.
Plus
so two in total, is that what you're asking?
No, three in total.
Oh.
Right, yeah, it's designed to add another simple cycle unit and then a heat recovery unit, so three separate units, but two actual combustion units or gas turbines.
Three generators.
Okay. And this 88 megawatt simple cycle? That's essentially a duplicate of what you have, right?
Correct.
That's
yep.
What that was, is 88.
Yep.
And then what Darcy's alluding to is you could make that into a combined cycle down the road. It's just that last piece, he's saying, is the most expensive. But to Julie's point, if the economics would prove out long-term that you need a baseload facility, that's something we could consider, is
correct.
What you're saying.
Yep.
Yeah.
Keep going. I think I can safely drink coffee now.
So this is just quickly some of the information on Heskett and Lewis and Clark. The units are our three smallest coal plants. They basically have been around for 60 years. We still have two other, ownership and two joint-owned coal plants that still to supply our customers at Coyote and Big Stone. And our shares in those are 100 megawatts plus each. And those units certainly are larger in scale, over 400 megawatts in size, and certainly are newer than what these units are. And the other one to talk about on those units is the dates for the coal supply agreements we took into account on the retirement analysis, which for Lewis and Clark is the end of next year, and Heskett Station is the end of 2021. So we do have obligations, at least with the mines, at least to purchase, fuel through those dates, and would have, take-or-pay clauses or at least buyout clauses if we'd look for something earlier.
And just say so if it's something that can't be discussed publicly, but are you aware of any concerns as far as coal supply with the Westmoreland bankruptcy situation up there, or are you confident in getting delivery through the end of that coal contract?
Yeah, when they first initially filed their Chapter 11, we were pretty nervous and had that as one of our scenarios that we were looking out to prepare for. But they have since emerged from Chapter 11, and through the whole process, they have not missed a beat. So they have continued to operate as normal during their filed period and since then, and they have indicated that they will honor the contracts until the end. So we, at this point, are pretty confident that we will continue to get our coal deliveries.
So the next few slides show some of those changing assumptions. The first one are natural gas prices. So we're going back to the 2013 Integrated Resource Plan, which ends up being the yellow, the gold line. So that would have had a starting price at $3.50 per MMBTU or decatherm and would have escalated from that. We get into 2015, the blue line, 2017, and now 2019. We keep seeing those commodity costs for natural gas prices keep dropping. Dropping and at least becoming certainly much lower in each forecast, which continues out for that 20-year period that Brian talked about. The same thing holds true if we look at MISO on-peak and off-peak energy prices. You know, 2013, we're out at a $30, 2015, almost $40 for a starting price, and we end up seeing those continue to drop as well as we went through the 2017 and now 2019 IRP.
Darcy, before you leave that, can we talk a little bit more about the natural gas prices and those?
Sure.
Predictions, where do they come from? You know, are you testing a variety of different sources? It's just,
yep.
We put a lot at stake with these natural gas price predictions, and like, what if they're off?
Yep. So one of the things we do in developing this is we go back to the gas supply department, and they're the ones that end up developing that forecast for us. And it's the same forecast that we end up using, at least on our gas supply side for our natural gas customers. And so they're really using a combination now of index prices and weighting those for the various hubs. And at least for some of the gas prices internally, we're looking at what we've been purchasing contracts for recently and then kind of a blend with other indexes.
And how long are the contracts?
So a lot of those contracts, they're looking at what the historics have been recently. But what we're doing is we're basically looking and using those indexes, I think, over a five-year average, and then we're applying an escalator after that 5 years. That's how they're
so
coming
do
up
you
with that.
Look at long-term contracting for gas? I mean, I know you're buying from a company you own, but or then your parent company. So, like, can you look at a 20-year gas supply contract?
So we've looked at those things. The one thing we end up having is at least the gas turbines today, we run them as peakers. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of times you can't get a contract, at least for gas out, probably more than a year, maybe two at the most. The other one is once you make those contracts, a lot of those you're committed then to burn some amount of that take or pay. And so it's been a much better fit for us to end up just having more of a spot price, we end up saying, as it ends up being for Heskett 3 and Heskett 4, we're actually buying that gas off Northern Border, and we're buying it through a different marketer, Tenaska, mm-hmm. is how we're sourcing that gas. And they're giving us an updated next day and intraday gas price every day. So at least we know if the units run, and that's been really a very good arrangement for us because we don't have a large reservation fee if we went out and contracted and had to have a firm, you know, path, mm-hmm. at least on a pipe for that.
Did you have a follow-up?
No. Well, you go ahead.
When you model the combined cycle, were you modeling that based on having long-term contracts? Or a few years ago, we talked about it, I don't think it was MDU, but in some contexts, there really weren't any long-term contracts to be had. Are there now?
So one of the things, if we would have assumed this same gas price forecast for the combined cycle, if we would have built that, we would have been back in, Randy, then what's the best way to source that? And would we have looked at to get these sort of costs to have some sort of more of a firmer sort of price versus having this intraday and next day sort of with Tenaska? It's one of the pieces when we got into that because we didn't go to the next steps. We haven't gone off to actually visit with those marketers and to see what they could have given us for a long-term agreement. But the last time we looked, I don't know that there was much really over that year or 2 years unless you really want to pay a premium for it.
Right. Which tells me they're not very confident either.
I think they'll give you a price, but you get back into, you know, the longer you get out, I think you're going to pay for it.
Sure.
And so that's kind of the place when we're looking at here is if this is more of the spot prices. And again, I think the natural gas price certainly has become much more stable. You know, it does have spikes where it may go up and down a little bit. But when we look at what the averages are, they're very low cost, and we expect that to continue, largely because of the abundant shale formations and developments, you know, on the continent. And, you know, of saying that really we do have a very strong feel, and again, all the other national indicators you look at continue to show this same sort of trend.
There's so much supply, I think,
right.
is the theory. I guess the only other thing I would add is, as Darcy and Brian both mentioned earlier, we obviously tested this with the sensitivities, and so when you look at, when we get to that slide, we did a +5 on gas prices. It still picked the simple cycle, and +5 would be more than doubling
what the current price is. So you're talking about, I don't even know if our base assumption was three something, I suppose. Another five, that's, you got $8 gas prices. I mean, and we're, it's still suggesting that we would move forward with the simple cycle. I'm getting ahead of these guys, but that will be demonstrated later. But certainly, we, you know, you're right. I mean, we've got to make an assumption on gas price, but then you test it against a various sensitivities. And then maybe just a follow-up, we do look at fixed price forwards across our eight-state system, but generally, you know, and Garrett, maybe you can help me with this, but I mean, that's 2 years out, maybe. I think we maybe have done some at three, but, you know, it's, to your point, it's hard to get folks locked in beyond that. And then, you know, we have, you know, looked at, does it make sense on the, that's physical, those are physical fixed price contracts. You know, you look at financial as well, but again, to Darcy's point, in a lot of these cases, you're paying a premium, and if your view is low for longer, sometimes that's hard to justify. But, you know, it's a balancing act, and we do look at it. To the point that we build something into the future, to Darcy's point, if it were a combined cycle type of facility where you have a constant need for, sure, for gas, we maybe have to think differently. Today, these are, you know, peaking units.
Yeah, I haven't seen a forecast model, and I've looked at a lot of them, that suggests there'll be any dramatic change in natural gas pricing for the foreseeable future, and you're talking a decade out,
right,
or more. You know, crude's a little more volatile, but you can't even find one of the outliers, one of the analysts that, you know, well, natural gas is going to be $10 and, you know, by 2025 or whatever. I mean, that doesn't even exist. I think on natural gas, I just don't foresee a production problem on the production side because of the shale formation, unless fracking were to be impacted by an environmental movement. But I think the bigger challenge, and not so much in the Midwest, would be from the transportation side. Getting it to market as pipeline placement becomes more of a challenge. Especially, but we don't have the same bottlenecks that they're developing in the East, for example. So, at least I don't think
those
we do.
Forces are real and they're strong and they're gaining ground. So, I mean, you have to base it on the models that exist. But I think we all need to realize that those could change dramatically in very short order, especially after the next election.
I've made this comment before and just want to keep throwing it out there. Yeah, because I suppose U.S. law doesn't necessarily impact things worldwide, but the anti-fossil fuels people, I think we do not emphasize enough the possibility of anti-fracking laws. And
or money drying up.
We can have all the supplies in the world, but if you're not allowed to do what it takes to extract it, it's problematic. And now, maybe there's more natural gas that doesn't require fracking than what I think. I don't know that.
You could hear some really dramatically different opinions up here.
Oh, yeah. Sure. Nope.
I think the legal framework is one thing, but I think where there's a lot of change happening is in the financial community, and they don't need policy changes in Washington to get at the financial, the people with the big money who support the industries where all you guys and everybody else goes to for financing. And there's a huge movement in that end on the holding companies accountable for how they're spending their money. And if you can't get financing for natural gas development, you're not going to be producing it, or whatever else it is, pipelines, I mean, you name it. They're attacking all those angles, and that, I don't see any way to stop that. But
yeah, I think that's where you want to have a diverse portfolio, frankly. I mean, and since these are peaking units, I will acknowledge what you're bringing up, though, and that is we just recently went out to the market for new debt. And we plenty of capacity. We were able to secure what we needed. But, you know, as a side note, we did have a couple people that wouldn't bid because we own coal.
Yeah.
So, I mean, just acknowledging that you're right, it is out there. Now, did it create an ultimate problem? No, we got excellent pricing for our customers. I'm completely satisfied with the pricing we got, but the point is, for the first time, we did see a couple people saying, we're not willing to bid your debt because you have coal in your portfolio. So.
So at least the natural gas and the energy prices, we keep seeing the forecast falling, at least for the starting points on those. So when we look then into the dates or how do we determine what a retirement should be, we ended up taking Heskett 1, Heskett 2, Lewis and Clark, and we varied their retirement dates. So one of those was looking at 2029, 2024, 2021. Each time we kept moving those dates up, we ended up showing greater customer savings in the earlier dates. We also allowed the model at the end of 2021 to basically reselect any one of those units to basically for an additional five-year life at really zero capital addition. So it basically had to run at whatever the current fuel and O&M was, but no additional CapEx, and the model wouldn't select any of those three. And as I mentioned before, we did look at some of the trends in historic coal and other prices and competitiveness, and then also in this internal revenue requirement model that Travis will talk about, showing what's the customer impact of that retirement and replacement plan. Some of the operating information we'll just show on the units kind of going through. This ends up looking at, there's three colors. Lewis and Clark on the bottom is in green. Heskett 1 is kind of in the orange color, and Heskett 2 is in blue. The solid lines are their availability factors. So the units are well maintained, and they perform very well for us. So high availabilities, they come down when you end up having either a forced or a maintenance outage. They tend to run about 80% or higher, at least on availabilities. The capacity factors, though, how much generation do we get out of their potential? We've seen a significant decline on all of those units. Sometimes the curves differ a little bit by what's the minimum level that those plants can turn down to. As in Heskett 2 really has the most limiting turndown, and it really has to run at this much higher dispatch range just because of the type of unit it is. But the units have been becoming very impacted, you know, by markets and other things that we participate in, and basically run the majority of their hours at minimum load that we end up seeing, which is what the next slide is showing.
So, Darcy, are you bidding them in at that minimum? Like, you're just saying we got to keep these running at this level, and so you're probably losing money running those?
So we'll get through all those, and I'll show that because that factors into the economic analysis. What this would show for each unit, if we talk about Lewis and Clark at the top, this ends up being really where their minimum dispatch range is in that 34 to 37 megawatts. And by year, this is the percent of hours that they basically run at minimum.
Okay.
Conversely, you get to the end, this is basically the number of hours they'll run at their full output. Again, by years, by their dispatch range. And so our strategy has been, and largely it gets into how do you get fuel. When you buy coal, you're basically making a commitment with the mine you're going to take so much. You know, and some of these, at least Heskett has take-or-pay arrangements that we have to take the fuel. And so when the units available, our marketing strategy has been to start the units and to basically put them in as a must-run into the market every day at their minimum, and then they'll dispatch economically above that, which is what this shows, that even Heskett 2, Heskett 1, they'll basically sit at minimum.
And the one on the far right is how often they're dispatching economically?
At their full output. So anything between this is really anything that's either an economic dispatch or in some cases for maintenance and issues with the units, we can't turn them down as far. And so we end up finding out here like Heskett 2, this number of hours that we would have had in 2018 is not because it dispatched economically there, but because that was the minimum output we had because of some maintenance issues mm-hmm. with the unit. But the trend has been you end up seeing these big jump in all the units. Really, it goes back to in the blue color 2016, you know, the units sit and run at minimum. So there's something more economic in the market, and we'll end up showing what that is. Mm-hmm. So one of the drivers behind Lewis and Clark and Heskett then we end up having is, at least in coal prices, where we've been since 2010 have been on the rise. You know, this spike really relates to more of an outage at Lewis and Clark, and so some of the impacts with the mine on their fuel pricing when we're not taking coal. But also the other big impact is at Lewis and Clark, this is the truck haul that we have or the freight to get from the mine to the plant. We've also seen an increase in that. So this cost is going against what we end up seeing for those natural gas prices of coming down, the coal prices, particularly for these small plants, have been on the rise.
Darcy, on that last slide with all the bars,
yep.
How would that look different for, like, Big Stone?
So we end up seeing for Big Stone, basically, and Coyote, they're more likely to come down to their minimum loads at night, but we do see them ramp up quite frequently, if not almost every day, up to what their maximum output is. And part of that, I'll show you, we're coming up on another slide, is more of the comparison of what their fuel cost is for all the units as compared to what the MISO market average price is. And I think that will help show the difference of those units as compared to these three.
One thing I would say about Big Stone in the recent period, Otter Tail has been able to negotiate some more variable pricing with the transportation piece, which has helped them.
Sure. Is Coyote the most efficient?
It would have the lowest fuel cost, largely because of its mine mill
location.
Yep. So Heskett the same way. We end up seeing that coal prices have been increasing. You know, the freight cost change on the railroad probably isn't quite as impactful as what the truck haul is over Lewis and Clark, but still has been increasing. The other one Heskett ends up having, you see the larger jump, that would be the opening of the Coyote Creek mine. You know, when Coyote Station moved away from the Beulah mine and went over to Coyote Creek. So the only remaining tons out of the Beulah mine end up being just for Heskett Station. The other one that goes with that, we look at operating costs. So at least the red lines are labor at Lewis and Clark. Blue is the O&M non-reagents and then reagent costs. So particularly for the O&M costs and the labor cost at those units, and one of the impacts certainly at Lewis and Clark is being in the Bakken region and what it takes to basically retain employees or to find new ones has been impactful for that resource. Same thing happens at Heskett Station. We end up seeing this increase in labor, and at least over there particularly the increase in reagents. You know, the other O&M without reagent costs really also reflects the timing of your major maintenance outages when they happen. So when we look at the units, this is kind of where we get into what's that dollar per megawatt hour, you know, dispatch cost or cost to run the units. Two ways to look at competitiveness in the market is at least the cost of fuel, which is what we bid them into the market at on a dollars per megawatt hour basis for the three units. These numbers are taken from the 2018 FERC Form 1 numbers we ended up having. So at least to get something that others could look at, it was a more uniform set of numbers to look at, and also adding in what would be considered the variable O&M costs. And that would be as compared to what the MISO market purchase prices we had were and also in 2018. So in that, whether it's based upon the fuel cost, we end up seeing that Coyote Station and Big Stone are both less than this on both the fuel and variable O&M. But we get into Lewis and Clark, Heskett 1 and Heskett 2, we end up seeing there's a significant spread that we end up having versus what those MISO market purchase prices are.
Why is the fuel cost so different for Heskett 1 and 2?
So some of that ends up being that the efficiency of the units makes a difference. So even if the dollars per ton are the same, what happens is the heat rate or efficiency of those units are not the same. Heskett 2 is larger, so it's more efficient. So its cost on a dollar per megawatt hour of fuel will be lower cost than Heskett 1. And when you add in all O&M costs, we end up seeing that, you know, those numbers become even more significant, at least for Heskett 1, 2, and Lewis and Clark. For comparison, we ended up putting Thunder Spirit Wind 2 down on the bottom of this. Again, our purpose in investing in Thunder Spirit 2, and again, that's a 25-year levelized cost, all O&M, all capital, including the benefit of the production tax credit, and also at the 21% federal income tax level was $25.63 is the 25-year levelized cost. And we really invest in those. Again, that goes back to where we end up seeing MISO market purchases are.
So Coyote, that's 2018 number you said?
Yep.
With the higher lignite pricing, with the higher reagent cost?
Yes.
Maybe not quite. Well, I suppose you still have you're feeling labor pressure at that plant as well because of proximity to the Bakken.
We do.
Yeah.
Or not, a little more stable.
Yeah, I would say than Lewis and Clark.
Sure.
As I compare Big Stone and Coyote, the first two columns, Coyote's just a slightly higher, but then when you add the other, the non-variable O&M costs, then Big Stone's almost $2 higher. Is that transportation, or what's the non-variable cost that Big Stone seems to be quite a bit higher?
So, again, these would end up being 2018 actuals, so you'd probably have to go back in and see what they had for maintenance and other sorts of things that were maybe more of those one-time, you know, sorts of costs that come periodically.
Okay.
Do you levelize or normalize the extraordinary maintenance costs on a given year when you're looking at a comparison like this just because it's more of a one-off?
So for this analysis, we just wanted to look at in 2018 because it goes back to those other comparisons when we ended up looking why in 2018 did the units run at their minimum. And this was kind of an analysis we were doing to end up seeing what's that spread from what we would bid them in at fuel to what we purchased in the market. It's just visually showing today or last year in 2018 what was the position of those units. And so when you look at what the costs are for MISO energy prices going out, the natural gas prices and other things, and coal prices, we don't expect these spreads to shrink, but actually keep growing, I would say, at least at
so when we Lewis and Clark. Look at this, to Randy's point, there's not a but. You need to keep this in mind for this particular unit in 2018 because this happened and it's not likely to happen again.
So again, when we look at the when we go back then and we talk about the integrated resource plan modeling, one of the things we're doing is we're taking this look at what our historic spends have been in major maintenance and O&Ms, and that's what's really driving that levelized cost in the model that we end up having forecasting out what we're going to spend. In this case, we're just doing a snapshot of what the position was in 18. So what we end up having for O&M costs in the IRP models are more of that levelized to try to take out when those spikes and valleys come in.
But directly to 18, I'm not aware, and Alan, I'm looking at you, between Big Stone and Coyote, that there was any major?
Big Stone, I think, had a major outage in 18.
So maybe that's driving some of that. Okay. But as you were, to be fair, I think if you were to pull up 2017's form, you're going to see a similar stacking order. It might be a little bit different in terms of the dollars per megawatt, but I don't think the stacking order would move significantly from what's being shown here. Right, Darcy?
It would not.
So, we picked 2018, but if you were to look at other years, I think you'd have a similar story. It might, numbers change a little bit, but.
So, again, our fleet competes in MISO, at least for dispatch, because MISO will dispatch all generation to serve all load. This is at least a curve, and it's from SNL, S&P Global, where they end up putting together a MISO generation supply curve, and they use that off more of this FERC Form 1 data that's available, or EIA data for all facilities. So the last year of full actual data that we had in the analysis and looking back is really what was available at the end of 2017. So this would be back. We talked about 18 was the previous slide. If we'd go back to 17, we see kind of that similar place. What the line ends up showing is this is across the MISO entire supply curve they end up having. This is MISO's minimum load, average load, and full load. When we look at resources that stack up, the colors indicate the different types of resources. So you see more of the renewables that are in the bottom, the hydros, and in some cases nuclear falls in here. The reds and the oranges really get to where all the coal plants sit, at least in this dispatch curve. So gas has now moved itself into this dispatch range largely because those commodity costs have come down into that $2.50 that it will compete with coal, but this curve has become very flat and very competitive. And when you add in all of your generation supply costs, so variable O&M pieces, you end up finding Coyote and Big Stone, at least on this entire curve, you know, still fall within between the MISO minimum load, full load, but Lewis and Clark, Heskett 1 and 2 are outside of that normal dispatch band. You know, we do see the units do dispatch up at Heskett 1 and Lewis and Clark, largely because of other plant outages or transmission constraints really would cause it to move. But we wanted to use this as another piece of information, not just our own in-house, but at least another source of data that does show the competitiveness of those resources versus all the other resources in MISO.
Darcy, have they been called on, were they called on during some of the emergency op times, like January 30th, and that were these units used?
So January 30th, all our coal was online, and they would have been dispatched up because LMPs jumped. We also did see that all of our gas turbines did get a start, and they all came online, and they all ran as well.
At full capacity, or how much?
Some of our gas, the coal plants, I think, all went to their, we had a few of the units MISO was holding back for more of their spin and regulation,
sure.
Kind of that emergency sort of piece mm-hmm. they were holding, but they were all capable of running, and I'd have to go back. We have some background on what they all did, but I think some of them were held back for spin. Where they could have economically have been dispatched.
Okay.
MISO have a generation supply curve pricing. I'm having a little trouble. That's 20, 40, 60, 80, 100. Is that what that is on the left side?
So this would be a dollar per megawatt hour. So this is $20 per megawatt hour, 40, 60, 80, 100. Yep, that's what those prices would be and how they stack.
I read it.
That's impressive.
Yep.
Yep. Those are, I can barely even see that there are dots over there.
I forgot what I was going to say. Or ask.
It's the eye test today.
Yeah.
I don't imagine there's any type of a similar model that would strip out subsidies, energy subsidies. I just think it would be fascinating, to say the least, to look at the resources that were picked, how they came online, but what's the actual cost when you take out PTCs, impact, or you know, the benefit of an ITC, et cetera.
So one of the pieces, that example, even when we look here, this does not include capital costs. So even like on the renewables, when someone makes those, it's a business decision.
Sure.
But now you're looking at, from what it's going forward position, how does that compete as far as where it's at in that marketplace? So.
No, and I realize that.
Yep.
I mean, that's the cost, and that's over
so
here.
So once you made the investment, this is how it participates.
MISO never sees that. Cost, like take
no.
out, I mean, how would they even get
they
to
don't.
That?
I don't know.
Plus, different people have different opinions about what a subsidy
yep.
is.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
We
yes.
do, I will acknowledge, we do get that a lot, you know, at our plants. Well, is it, are we getting beat out because of the PTC, you know, and if you were to take that, and in today's wind prices, even if you didn't get the PTC, you know, because, again, the economics have come down substantially, it would even be hard for Lewis and Clark, as an example, and Heskett to compete against a non-subsidized.
Mm-hmm.
I think we kind of looked at some of those numbers. I don't have them in front of me, but, you know, to your point, we got to make the decision based on what the total cost is, including the subsidy, because we, you know, we're going to pass that benefit to the customer. But just for interest of people, because we do get the question a lot, well, is it because they're subsidized?
I get the question a lot,
yep.
too, and you can look at, okay, so you can talk about a 1.6 to 1.9 cent range for wind, for example. And then when you, it's of course, it's not as simple as just taking, well, but then there's 2.4 on the,
yeah.
well, but you have to take that over 25 years, so call it a dime, or not a dime, call it, you know, the 1.6 to 2.0, whatever moves to 2.6 to 3 or whatever it is. It's still very
competitive.
So we're just showing this information because not just using Brian's IRP model and not you just strictly using what Travis is going to talk about on the revenue requirement, you know, we also went back and looked at a lot of this historical data to come up with the conclusions, at least on the retirements, you know, at least at the plants of their end of their coal supply agreements. So Lewis and Clark at the end of 2020 and Heskett Station the end of 2021, and we end up believing at least those reductions from those plant closures, even with the addition of the unit and market purchases, is a better economic choice than what we had for a plan in 2017, and also provides significant customer savings. So with that, we'll continue more with what the modeling results showed, and then I think Travis is going to talk about what the revenue requirement analysis showed separate from Brian's model.
One more quick question on this MISO supply curve, Darcy, since
yes.
you're here. So when we're hearing about all the different retirements in the MISO fleet, are most of those the ones to the right of that?
They would either be units to the right or ones that would have had a requirement. So they would have had to make a large capital addition for Regional Haze,
sure.
something else, and they would have made that economic choice. that they may have been one of these resources here, but rather than to invest a significant amount of capital, they chose to shut down, or based upon a state policy.
And then who looks at if those units are gone and we have an event like the 30th of January? What fills the need?
So again, that's MISO does that, I think. So we do that ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Because one of the things we certainly look at, and the other reasons why we continue to like putting in peaking turbines, is that if the renewables aren't there, that we're going to have sufficient generation mm-hmm. for our customers.
So this 88 megawatts is your answer to that?
That is part of our answer to that, and at least it gives us that portfolio, but it's also showing it on a lease cost, is that we're not just strictly going off to renewables sure. and batteries. So it's kind of a combination of many things. But that's one of the checks and balances, I think, is to look at what would happen if those renewables are there. And certainly we have a significant amount of gas and coal still remaining to cover what our peak is. Maybe not the peak plus the planning reserve margin, but at least to cover our peaks.
And then, Darcy, just to add to that, MISO does look at this holistically. Like, you, if you want to retire one of your facilities, you have to let MISO know, and they do a study, or can you maybe describe a little bit of that?
So they do that on a very short-term basis per their tariff. That really what they do on the retirement attachment Y looks out really for that next 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and when they do the resource adequacy Brian talked about for how we meet peak demand, that's really just for the year out.
Mm-hmm.
But they do the other pieces with the OMS survey and other things to try to get 5-10 more years worth of data, you know, at least through utilities, and also looking at, I think, Purdue provides some of the background information as well, as to try to get a longer
yeah.
look.
The more I ask myself about that question, the more I am convinced that they don't view it as their role to be looking at that. They think it's the utility's role and the state regulators to make sure that there are resources to meet peak and beyond. I mean, they have their planning margin, et cetera, but they're not going to be out there making sure that there's enough resources to meet the worst-case scenario beyond 1 year or whatever.
Well, they do state that, I think, kind of to cover themselves, that this is not our stated function,
yeah.
but they do the research.
Yeah, but that's like a six, I mean, it's like a short term. If some unit couldn't be taken offline for like a short amount of time, then
they don't say,
no, you can't retire this unit
right.
ever
they,
in the next 10 years.
No, they don't regulate that,
yeah.
but they do the research looking out. I'm not sure what the time frame is, but they provide that to all the generators and, I believe, the public, and it's more of an indication of, is it a good time for somebody to build because there's
sure.
going to be need in the market, or are we flush with capacity and don't build anymore because you're not going to get your money's worth out of it. So they provide that kind of information, but again, they, like you say, it's... They don't force anybody to meet that or to be the one person that has to be the next one to build. But they do provide that information, and they share that with their utility members when they start to get a little nervous about how much capacity. They do talk to the generators and say, we're getting short, and that's their indication that it's probably time for somebody to build.
Mm-hmm.
Again, it's not regulatory, but it's advisory.
All right. Now we'll get into some of the results from the IRP modeling. This first slide here would be our base case results, assuming the plant retirements were included in this. So in 2022, it is selecting Heskett 4. It did select one of the wind RFPs of 54 megawatts, and then also additional 10 megawatts of capacity to get through 2022. 2023, it picked a solar 100 megawatts from the RFP, and then 2025, it picked a combined cycle from the RFP. And then out in the later years, it picked 5 megawatts of self-built solar. And then, as Darcy mentioned, we did not shortlist any of these RFP options because of the generator interconnection cost not known. So, but we did include them in the modeling just to show that we'll go out in the future and look at another RFP to see if these prices are still stable.
Was that, that was straight solar without storage?
Yep, that's correct.
So the wind RFP, the 54 megawatts, that's not one that you already are pursuing?
No, that would have been from the RFP, just included in the modeling.
And again, just to make sure we're all on the same page, these are in the base case, but they don't include the interconnect. So that's the unknown that makes the decision to not move forward with those, because you're basically stacking them up against Heskett 4, and Heskett 4 does assume the interconnect costs, or we already have them. Mm-hmm. And Alan will talk a little bit more about that, but it's not really a fair comparison because those don't include what we would pay to interconnect.
Yeah. Yep. So is it each of the, all of this combined is what you need to meet your, the, what you're short in 2021?
In 2022, yep, that's what the modeling would, that's what the model picked, yep.
Heskett, you have the interconnect though already.
Correct.
So Heskett's really providing that capacity replacement for the retirement of the units. The wind provides that little bit of capacity, but it's that also that additional piece of energy, at least that the model is wanting to have, is why it's picking those two.
Yep.
Why would it pick 5 megawatts in 2038? It's such a tiny...
It just needs a little bit of capacity, basically, to solve for 2038.
So those last years, if you're short 5 megawatts, it's going to find the cheapest thing to get you 5 megawatts.
Yep.
Business opportunity.
They're all. I get the mailers.
Yep.
They show the, are you near, and they show the photo of a 345.
Oh.
KV, are you near one of these? You can have solar.
This next slide just kind of breaks down our zonal resource credits. This would be 2019. Shows in the gold color would be our gas, natural gas units. The blue would be our coal. And then the green is the DSM. And then the 8% would be renewable. That's what we get for our zonal resource credits by resource type in 2019. Then going out to 2024, this includes the retirements of the three coal plants and then just the addition of Heskett 4. It doesn't include those wind or solar RFP that was included in the base case. So this would just include the Heskett 4 addition. So the gas goes up to 48% of our zonal resource credits and coal goes down to 36%. And then the other two stay about the same. These next three slides kind of show the results for all the sensitivity runs. I won't go through all the results because there's a lot here. But the main thing to take away is all the scenarios does select Heskett 4. Might not be in 2022. Just kind of depends on what the scenario is. But it does select them in all the sensitivities. And pretty much all the other resources are pretty much the same selected throughout the sensitivities too. And then the bottom two lines just kind of shows the net present value in millions of dollars over that 50-year study period, and then kind of the difference between the base case. So all these ones, this is the low gas, the two high gas, and the high CT scenarios. This next slide, this shows the low market energy prices, the high, both high energy, and then the 90% coincident factor. The 90%, obviously, you need more resources to meet needs, so it selects more resources versus the other scenarios. And then this last one, this is where Heskett 4 is actually not selected in 2022. But it is selected in 2034, and that's the low growth scenario. It just doesn't need that capacity from that Heskett 4 as soon. It does select a different resources, but it pushes Heskett 4 out on the low growth scenario. And then going in.
Is that $30 carbon tax? Is that per megawatt or per ton of carbon?
I'd be per ton of carbon emitted from each all of our fossil fuel units.
How do you guys come to $30? I know Minnesota's at 23 per ton right now. I know some people are estimating up to 40 in some states is where you should be at. How'd you guys come down to 30?
We've been using 30 for the past 4 or 5 IRPs. We used to do a 52, but now we've just done the 30.
So part of that, we end up kind of having the bookends. At least the base case doesn't have anything, and at least we're kind of having a higher value probably than what some other states have at 30.
Sure.
So if we end up being at 0 and 30 and that's your bookends, anything in and nothing changes, anything in between is going to give you the same results.
Okay.
So if we'd start to see something would show up that 30 would change something, then we may go in and say, well, let's try a 20 and a 15 and see if we can find where that changeover point is. So we've kind of pushed it out, I think, beyond what we continue to see other states have at 30. Nothing changes, so that's why we continue to use that as just kind of a bookend.
Gotcha. I saw that Minnesota opened up a docket. I'm assuming they're going to up their cost of carbon probably the next 5 years. But are you guys seeing that in maybe Montana or any of those other states? Are they using any social cost of carbon yet?
No.
Yeah.
Not in our electric territories.
And now I'll just get into our 2-year action plan from the 2019 IRP. The first one we've kind of already talked about is going forward with retirements of the 3 coal plants. The next one, Garrett will talk a little bit more in detail, but we file an advanced determination of prudency for the Heskett 4 unit. And then we'll also have the regulatory filings as necessary for the 3 coal plant retirements and the additional capital on books. The next one here, we've kind of talked about, we'll be issuing another request for proposal before our next IRP cycle. And then if we do have any short-term capacity needs, we'll either go to the MISO auction or bilateral agreements. And then next one, as we've seen, solar's been picked, so we'll continue to look at solar batteries in the future. And then
so is this the next RFP, is that to get at a more serious determination on the wind, the 54 megawatts of wind that the proposal is calling for?
It would be to see if more of those internet connection costs are more finalized.
Sure.
So we can know what that actual cost are for those.
So how long can you wait before you need to start pulling the trigger on meeting that need for 2022? I mean, will you evaluate it again in 2021 and see if it's still there and then pull the trigger? Or I mean, it feels like it's not that far away.
So we're probably about 6 months or maybe a year out really from when we're talking about issuing that. You know, some of that is just the timing as MISO gets through. I think they're just starting the August 17 definitive planning cycle, which that's where a lot of these proposals we were seeing really end up coming out of either that cycle or
sure.
the one after it.
If they get their interconnect and how much it costs.
Yep.
Because we did some sensitivities as well based on those unknowns, you know, depending if you be at, you know, $500 or $1,000 per kW, at least on the high end for an outlier, you could almost add $25 per megawatt hour to any proposal cost to pay for those interconnection costs.
And then do you rerun the model and decide what best meets the need then when you get those new RFPs in?
So we either go back and include it in the 2019 IRP model, or depending when we start the 2021 would include it at least as kind of the precursor to that process. Mm-hmm. So we'd have both.
Do you have any idea when you might be coming to us then with a proposal to meet that need?
Like I said, we're just kind of looking at some of those timing pieces, and it may end up being, you know, 6 months to a year before we go out for that RFP, and depending how that goes, we determine what the next steps are. And we would come back in to talk about that.
And in the meantime, as he mentioned, the short-term capacity deficits, we'll be looking at the MISO market for,
Which those prices have been very low. So far. So
I should have asked you this along the way, but when you're looking at, we talked a lot about projecting natural gas pricing. How do you look at borrowing rates? And your access to capital, you said, isn't really an issue, but in terms of interest rates and borrowing rates, do you foresee a significant change over the next several years, or how do you model that?
So basically, we rely on our Treasury Department. They put together estimates on what's going on with the interest rates. And so as we put together our model forecasts over the five-year, we're going to rely on estimates that they're generating. Now, where do they get those from? The external, similar to how we're looking at gas price, right? Look at multiple different assumptions out there and come to a determination on average, a mean, and or a median, and kind of come up with an assumption there. I mean, what we're seeing today is, yeah, the interest rate environment has increased, you know, relative to when it bottomed out. But I don't know that we're projecting anything that's, we continue to see, I would say, a steady rise. That's, I mean, is that kind of fair, Garrett? Yep. But, yes, we are looking at that, and that would be factored into any sort of financing related to these projects that we're talking about. That's a part of our five-year forecasting process.
All right, and then the last two here on the two-year action plan, well, we continue to develop and monitor the impacts of regional haze for Coyote. And then the last one will be continue implementation of our energy efficiency and our demand response programs that we have currently.
So on the Coyote.
Yeah, I don't want to let that go through one bullet point on one slide.
Go ahead.
Well, tell us more about that. That, I think, is my understanding, a significant change would be needed up there to keep that going long term. And
do you want to go?
So Otter Tail is taking the lead on, obviously they're the operator, on the environmental portion of that. And they've developed a range of options that could possibly be required. And it's a very wide range. And at this point, we really don't know what the State Health Department or also the EPA would eventually rule on as to what their control requirements would be. And so at this point, it's still, I'd say, wide open. There's a wide range of what controls they might have to put on, and until that part is settled, it's just an unknown.
So what is the timing of even when the controls are required?
So the controls would be required to be on, and I'll look to Alan, I think it's 2028 would be the end date. Now, sometimes those dates could be moved up a little bit, but the compliance date would be 2028.
So as Jay mentioned, right now that basically multiple options have been presented to the North Dakota DEQ, and essentially we're, as co-owners, we're kind of in holding pattern a little bit. What we have agreed as co-owners to do is take a look at those options, and I'm sure you'll be hearing from Otter Tail on this as well, but look at those options, and each owner will be looking at economics based on, okay, well, if option one was implemented, if option two, if option three, what does that mean? And that's really where we're at today. We are in the throes of, you know, looking at that analysis along with the other co-owners of the facility, and as Jay mentioned, that's where we're at in the process. I believe, according to the timeline, there may be some preliminary indications. At least what I understood from Otter Tail was potential preliminary indications by the end of this year, but potentially you don't really know anything till July of next year, and these things kind of continue to take on a life of their own once you start the discussion and dialogue. But
what would potentially happen by the end of this year?
We may have some preliminary indications from the DEQ, is kind of what I heard at one point.
Yep.
On which preferred approach they like, correct, want you to pursue.
Yep. But it sounds like it'd be preliminary. So, again, we wouldn't really necessarily have data at that point to really move forward with any sort of recommendations is kind of how I interpreted that. But
and what kind of leeway does DEQ have to ultimately decide versus EPA? I mean, do they have to run their plan by the EPA and get the blessing?
Yes.
Yes. If it's basically the DEQ does their whole process, and I believe it right before it's finalized, then it goes to the EPA, and the EPA can either say, yes, we like that, or nope, you didn't do good enough, which happened in the first round with North Dakota. I think over the, I don't know if you're familiar, but the SCR and SNCR for NOx control, and that ended up being a court battle. And so, but that's the step, is that the state finalizes their plan, and then the EPA either approves it or overrides them.
And once the EPA approves it, say, can a new EPA come in and require something different, even after it's been approved? And you don't know?
I don't know the answer to that.
Okay. I suppose that would take a whole new rulemaking.
Well, it's not a rulemaking at the time. It's the approval, basically, of their air permit, or the plan in their air permit. And I think once those are finalized, it's pretty hard for the agency to come back and undo that.
Mm-hmm.
But then, the regional haze rule is a many multiples of years. Doesn't finalize until 2064, and in every 10 years there's another shot at it. So the next shot, I think, that would be reasonable after the plan has been approved by EPA would be the following 10-year implement. Although along with the EPA approval, there's also public interest groups with their opportunity to sue and challenge and take that up through the courts. So there's multiple steps before everything is really known.
And so DEQ, or with the ultimate approval from EPA, approves a plan to get to a certain point. What is the goal of this next step? Is it to cut their regional haze by a certain percentage, or to a certain amount, or what is the goal of
round? It's all based on visibility. And so I don't think there's a real necessary goal to meet certain emissions limits, but the emissions are what gets you to the visibility determination. I could be wrong that there might be something in there that tells you to get to a certain emissions amount per state, but I believe it's all pretty much based on modeling of visibility at these class one areas, which are essentially national parks or things like that.
So even the goal is kind of hazy.
well said.
I mean, the end goal is to have the visibility pristine like it was before, influenced by man, so to speak, 2064, right? So,
yep.
But the glide path is kind of what's in between there.
So Los Angeles will cease to exist.
Could you talk, are you done with Hayes? Could you talk a little bit too about the energy efficiency and demand response? I mean, it doesn't seem like we've done a lot in that area, and there might be more low-hanging fruit that could be.
So I think part of that is it's the opportunity. Maybe that's the better word in the action plan. There's an opportunity we have with the retirement and still of those deficits, potentially in the future, of capacity and energy to do a deeper look at new programs. And so we've talked in the past things of the AC cycling and the rest of those. Maybe there are other customer programs that we could look at.
Are those in the models? Like, could the model have picked it? No. How come?
So part of that is when we ended up having at least some of the AC cycling and the rest of those, I mean, that was from the 2017 IRP. So it's one of those we'd have to go through again, and we were looking at that probably for something we're going to do for 2021, saying, should we bring that back? Because we have sufficient capacity now, really, till we get into, this 2022 sort of year.
Mm-hmm.
And so the real timing to look at that really isn't to have tried to throw it into this analysis, but it's kind of throw it in the next one. And then we can take a broader look beyond just saying AC cycling. Are there other things that we should be looking
right.
at? So we don't cut ourselves short and run after that. We looked at it before and miss something else, whether we're looking at other LED programs or other stuff that we should have looked at.
I thought that, I could be totally wrong, but I thought the AC cycling was like 10 megawatts.
Yeah, that's what it was.
And you've got a 10-megawatt power purchase there, so I'm curious that it wasn't in the mix of possibilities for your model to pick.
So the one thing is the AC cycling, its cost of that program is similar to the capital cost or the cost of what a combustion turbine would be. And what Brian is showing in those capacity purchases are saying you'll buy something from the market that's cheaper, at a lower cost.
Yeah, so
something that's 10 cents versus something that's a dollar per unit.
Last time when we had fully developed this, and I can't remember, Darcy's alluding to, was it a couple of years ago when we looked at this really in detail? It wasn't cost competitive at that time, Julie, to the other options, right? So that's why we ended up not bringing it all the way forward. But is that fair?
It was cost competitive, but we ended up with a large commercial customer came in and went into our commercial demand response C-Power program.
Okay.
So that would have been a $4 program versus a $9 program.
Mm.
And taking that $4 program basically took the need away for the $9 10-megawatt program.
So we had another option that was better cost, I guess, is what you're saying. So
that came out of customers.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay, we'll get into the retirement analysis a little bit. You'll see on the first slide there, Teresa Addison is also listed on that slide, and she did a lot of work, and she's sitting here today, and will be assisting if we need to go that route. She's with our power production group. So what I tried to do on the retirement analysis, Darcy pointed out that what the model that they're working on does this 50-year net present value, but it's really difficult to bring that net present value back to an impact on customers. So what this analysis was intended to do was to provide that revenue requirement that you guys are used to seeing and to provide a look at the options and to provide our company with the opportunity to see that revenue requirement impact on customers of the decision and help support that decision to retire those. So what I have presented here is, and this is going to be our integrated system costs, so that'll include, you know, the costs of all of these plants over our Montana, North Dakota, and South Dakota territory. And Darcy had mentioned earlier, Lewis and Clark, Heskett, the large drivers in that revenue requirement of continued to operate is labor. That is certainly the biggest cost. Also included in that is any depreciation that we have on those and return on the rate base of the existing facilities. There's some other operating costs, coal severance, for instance, at the Heskett stations. So you'll see there our total cost, if we do not retire those, what we've modeled that to be is just about $34 million on an annual basis.
So you have year 2023, is that like through that year? Is that just kind of wondering what the year designation?
Yeah, and what we tried to do was that would be the first full year of Heskett 4 online. So to kind of, we're going to be on this step down and then a step up, and that would really be the year when Heskett 4 is fully online, and we would see a transition from today, if you will, to this new environment that we'll be working in.
So this $33-34 million would be similar from now.
And what we've done is we've escalated those costs from today up through 2023.
Okay.
And we've tried to incorporate all of our known items, and we did our best to get a real good solid projection on those.
So like labor increases would be included in there on annual.
Yep. So then the next slide, as Darcy and Brian had indicated, Lewis and Clark at the end of 2020 and Heskett to retire that at the end of 2021, you'll see there that the revenue requirement on those now has been eliminated. On the footnotes there, you'll see the remaining plant balance at the end of life of each of those is listed at 38.2 for Lewis and Clark, and at $32.4 million for Heskett's 1 and 2. One of the gap requirements is that upon the announcement of those end dates, that the requirement is that you accelerate that depreciation to get that plant balance to zero. And Garrett's going to talk a little bit about the deferred accounting order. Because of that, currently we are deferring that additional depreciation through the end of life of those plants. One of the things, I believe it was discussed a little bit as well, in order to keep those employees to that end of life, we have some packages that we put together, as well as to transition those employees to other employment with the company. So what we've got there is the sum of all those costs amortized over a five-year period. I mentioned the net value of those plants is just over $70 million. So what we have there is if we were to amortize that remaining plant balance over a 15-year period, that would add another just short of $9 million. Plant decommissioning, that is an estimate that we have had previously sent out for bids to get an estimate on that, and we are currently getting a much deeper dive on that, and they're reviewing and going to put together some estimates that we expect to get later this month, I believe. So all of these numbers obviously will be refined a little bit as we go through. Then finally, the last item on there, Heskett 4.
On plant decommissioning, you don't intend to, that's not property that's going to be sold off or something anyway. It's too close with the gas plants. So that'll continue to be MDU property, right?
At this point,
right, yes. Yeah, there's no intent at this point to sell off any property or buildings or anything.
And then the last item, the Heskett 4 station. We mentioned that'd be the first full year of that plant, and that's the full revenue requirement of that plant. You'll see there we have a total cost under this new scenario, including the amortization of the remaining life of those plants, as well as the amortization package on the employee retention, comes in at just over $22 million. Then the next piece that we have to look at is the fuel and purchase power. Darcy had a slide up there showing the cost of generation. He mentioned that we're running Heskett and Lewis and Clark at their minimums to keep those plants online should we need those. So we ran through our fuel and purchase power dispatch, including those plants, as well as excluding those plants, and you'll see there's a reduction from just about $80 million to $68 million, but we know that we need a small amount of capacity to replace what we were getting out of those plants when we replace them with the 88-megawatt turbine. So we have shown that in there as well at $4 per kW month. So just on the fuel and purchase power side, then, we would anticipate saving close to another $9 million in that first year of full operation.
The fuel and purchase power without retirements, that is assuming them at their actual run levels versus
yes.
full out?
Correct.
Okay.
Yep. It would be dispatch them just as if nothing were changing.
At minimums, basically.
Yep.
That ties back to this then.
And then just to summarize it all, again, these are integrated system costs. We obviously had to put a lot of estimates in there. What we are seeing is that through this point, our estimates are still holding up really well, and they were used in our decision process. And you'll see that there's about $11 million in non-fuel requirement, just short of $9 million in fuel requirement, for a total change of about $20 million. And again, that includes deferring some of those costs and recovering that either over a five-year or a 15-year period.
And this, well, Heskett's already covered on the interconnect side, the 88 megawatts. That includes the additional beyond that interconnection costs or no?
So for Heskett, there will be no additional interconnection right. costs for it. So all of the total all-in costs loaded are all included for that capital investment and...
Is that, so this only includes the 88 megawatts?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
But also the capacity purchases it includes.
So we concluded capacity purchases, and again, that was just to be made whole. So saying if we started out with 140 megawatts of capacity, this is the cost to still have 140. When we get into the resource plan, we've shown there's this little bit of excess or something else that may not be needed. But just to keep things whole, we included that amount in.
But this shows a 10 megawatt purchase. It shows purchases or purchase of 10 megawatts, but the wind RFP is...
Right. So we did that kind of separate from this, and again, we're just trying to make it whole of saying until we find what that next capacity resource is, and if we need to make up the whole 140 with another 140, we included an adder in there for what that bridge capacity would be.
So just to be clear, Travis's analysis assumes the 88 megawatt add
okay.
plus the incremental purchase of capacity on the market that we'd have to do for 2.8. So, and that's on... the slide, you want to back up, Travis, mm-hmm. but essentially the revenue requirement on the 88 million or 88 megawatt units included, plus if we wanted to get to 144 to make up for what we retired, we have to spend about 2.9.
So this mostly ties?
From a capacity, it's 100%. Similar. It's just we're buying the capacity, we're not
under buying the base. 56 megawatts.
Yes, versus
88
building wind and
plus 56 megawatts of purchase to equal what you're retiring, the
correct.
Exact megawatts that you're retiring, which is not the same as what the plan is calling for.
So you're...
It's more than what the plan is calling for.
More than.
Right.
It's more than.
And so will we, to Darcy's point, this is just to kind of show you that the economics shows this is cheaper for our customer. Will we exactly purchase up to that capacity? We may not.
So the economics will be even better.
They could
be better if we didn't purchase up
yep.
now
yeah.
to 144.
Okay. Mostly covers it. Victor, I'm going to grab you.
Yeah. I mean, the integrated resource plan, I mean, one of the things even internally when we talk about it, it generates a base case, right? But
right.
that base case, you don't always follow exactly what the model spits out, right? There's reasons why we didn't follow exactly what the model spit out. As Darcy alluded to, one of the biggest being the uncertainty around those MISO interconnect costs, because that basically said, go ahead and do wind, but it's because that wind was priced without those interconnect costs in there. Well, it's not really a fair comparison. So today, as he said already, we feel we would need to go back to do another RFP to get a true cost,
mm-hmm.
and we'd use that to compare to whether or not it makes sense to continue to purchase that capacity off the market or go ahead and build our own resource. So.
And then the analysis that Travis just went through was used to substantiate the IRP retirements.
Yeah.
So we took another look outside of the IRP in regards to the economics, and that supported then the decision.
So I believe we have till 11 on your guys' calendars, so we will try to hustle through the remaining deck here. And do you guys have hard stops at 11? I mean, I think we can get through a good portion of it, but...
I do have some folks coming for a meeting at 11, but if, I mean, don't...
Okay.
I'll just slip out if you guys need to keep going.
I can go longer, but not much.
Yep, and I don't think it's going to take us much longer. We're through the meaty part of the presentation, but... Okay, sounds good. Go ahead, Jay.
Yep, okay.
Just get the fluff, Jay.
Yeah.
Clean up hitter.
Clean up, yeah. Well, you do a good job, Jay. Yeah.
All right, so the retirement dates we've already talked about. I think we've already talked enough about that the facilities will be decommissioned and demolished. We will use plant employees that wish to continue on past the operation of the units to perform some of the initial decommissioning activities. That's a activity that'll probably take months, not years. So we'll keep those folks on for a while. I think it's probably also clear that we will be having gas units still operating at both facilities. So this isn't a complete facility closure. It's a retirement of the coal units, but both facilities will remain in operation with the gas-fired units. I think we already talked about Westmoreland and their Chapter 11. They've emerged from bankruptcy, and everything seems to be going quite well with them. Okay, so employee impact. When we made this announcement, we had 77 employees. Currently, we're already down to 71 combined between the two facilities. So the numbers are up there with how many are left at each facility. I guess the one thing that I would point out is at Lewis and Clark, we have not had very many resignations, and so we're really have only two temporary employees. So when we're losing employees, we're not replacing them with full-time permanent positions. We're replacing them with, I guess, basically full-time temporary employees, where their temporary runs through the end of the coal operations.
You had factored in retention as well, I noticed on a previous slide, so that would be a solidifier.
We do have a retention package and a severance package, so that
it's... That's already in play?
That's already in place, yeah. Yep. The employees are already aware of all those requirements. It seems to be working quite well at Lewis and Clark, maybe not quite so well at Heskett, where there's more opportunities locally. And so if you look here, we have 8 temporary employees already at Heskett, so we are filling more positions at Heskett than we are at Lewis and Clark. One other thing to note, we are trying to find positions for these employees within the company at the end of coal. But we already do have some folks moving on to other positions within the company. One example, we have Joe Geiger over here. Joe is our new director of generation. He's going to be replacing Alan Welty, who's also sitting over there, who is our current, they're both currently the director of generation. Alan's working on these projects more as Joe moves into his new role. But Joe's one example of folks that have taken different positions within the company. Let's see. So the next item there is the number of employees that we'll need after the coal operations are done. We have 4 employees at Lewis and Clark and 7 at Heskett. What I don't have up there is there one additional employee would probably be a supervisor of all of our natural gas operations, and likely would be positioned at Glendive, and so, but it would probably come from the employment or the employees at the two plants now. So that would be an addition up there, but it wouldn't be at one of these two plants. And as we mentioned, we do have the severance and retention packages, and the retraining for employees to try to find additional jobs within MDU. And the last thing that I've got is just, I guess, to answer the question, could those 2020 and 2021 dates change? And, you know, so we're, I guess, preparing, you know, for the worst. We expect that these plants should be able to operate till the end, but there are some things that could happen that might force a different decision. If we ended up with some unforeseen large capital expense, we may have to rethink whether we would spend that money or hasten the retirement. Examples of what could cause that, significant equipment failure or failure of a significant piece of equipment. Do we replace it or do we not? That's a decision we'll have to make if that sort of thing happens. We also have on there new environmental requirements. Hopefully we're at a point where there aren't going to be any new environmental things coming out, but you just never know, so that could be a possible impact. And the other thing is, if we had a significant loss of employees, which right now I think we're on track to be okay, but if we did have a mass exodus, there is a certain point where we may just not have enough employees to operate the plant. We do have some contingency plans in place so that we should be able to get through that, but it's just one of the things that we're considering. One of the other things on the changes of the dates is we could possibly go past the end of those 2 years or past the end of the coal contracts. There may be some reasons to continue the operations for another couple of months beyond those dates, so that could be a possibility also. So that's all I have.
Who's Ellen is up.
Ellen, go.
In the interest of time, I'll probably move through a few of these fairly fast. This is a picture of the existing Heskett 3 combustion turbine. As been mentioned before, and I'll get into it just a little bit, we would intend to make a mirror image of this as a Heskett 4. So I have a few slides that just kind of refresh us on Heskett 3, and I'll go through them fairly fast. Heskett 3 is a simple cycle combustion turbine, GE 70A heavy frame turbine, and a totally enclosed water to air cooled generator. It has it's 88 megawatts in size. As we've mentioned, Heskett 4 will be the same. It's natural gas fired, has a dry low NOx combustion package, and evaporative inlet air cooling for augmenting the power. And it went into commercial operation in 2014. So I'll probably just.
Alan, please don't be offended. I heard those folks coming in. I got your slides.
All right.
Thank you all very much. This is a good discussion.
There are just a few more details. I'll skip through those. It's interconnected at the Heskett 115 kV substation. And if you remember, we built a 24-mile natural gas pipeline from northern border up to Mandan, and we have a natural gas yard at Heskett.
And that pipeline has capacity for the second?
Yeah, absolutely. There were some
design. Pumping capability. You don't have to do anything with the pipeline, right?
Right. No, for adding another 88 megawatt unit, we don't need any additional compression or anything. Maybe just adjusting the valves, so to speak. So we've already talked about this a little bit. The site was designed with considerations to expanding it with another simple cycle or going to a 2-on-1 combined cycle arrangement. And I list a number of the things that in the site layout that would allow for that to happen. This is a general arrangement drawing showing Heskett 3, and if you look at that, if you just flip that over as a mirror image, you'd have a Heskett 4 in the darker color there. So you can see the broad outline of the site. We had left room for that and arranged this everything from the wastewater, stormwater, fire protection loop, all of that, so that it could fit right in there. So that's kind of a good backdrop to just talk about Heskett 4. It would be, as I mentioned, it would be a mirror image. It would have identical major equipment, especially the combustion turbine and the generator and some of the major components. That way we could use spare parts and so forth. It would interconnect, as I said, to the same places that the other unit is connected to. And then I wanted to just touch base on some of the cost savings that we would hopefully realize from building a Heskett 4 by having it on the same site, using similar equipment, and then, as has been mentioned earlier, the big ones are avoiding the network upgrades, connecting it to the MISO system by utilizing the replacement process to use the accredited capacity that we had with Heskett Unit 1 and 2 and applying it to Heskett 4. And I have a slide later that I'll get a little deeper into that. Their emissions netting as well, so if you remove Heskett 1 and 2, we can use some of the emissions that were produced from those and apply them to the air permit for Heskett 4, which would allow us to permit that with the broadest range of operating hours and conditions. Let's see. I think most of the other stuff, let's skip through that. So long list of stuff. The big ones are void network upgrade costs to hook to the transmission system, having the transmission and natural gas interconnections right there. So those add up to the largest savings, and then the list shows them many other ways that this is makes sense from a cost perspective. The preliminary project estimate is $80 million. And then I just wanted to give an update give you an idea of what our activities have been kind of to date. So we've worked on the conceptual design, engineering, and cost estimates. We're working on selecting our air permit consultant. So we'll be kicking that off and starting to populate the templates and so forth to work on what the air permit looks like. And then just a little time I wanted to spend on the MISO process here, if we're good on time. So at the time, earlier in the year, there was some uncertainty on what we call the MISO generator replacement process that Darcy alluded to earlier. It was proposed by MISO to FERC, and we were waiting for approval for that. So not knowing exactly the outcome of that at the time, we chose to submit the Heskett 4 into the MISO queue as if it was just another greenfield project, if you will, so that we would get into the queue knowing that there was probably a time when the replacement process would be approved by FERC and then we could withdraw. So you'll see that on this slide I show that we've made an application in April for that kind of normal process you would go through for a new generation, and then in May FERC did approve that generator replacement process, and we have since made application in June for using that, which is the one we need to use because it offers the ability to utilize the accreditation we had with the other units retiring. So one thing to note is the uncertainty around what your network upgrade costs could be in that MISO process. So we listed the range that we've seen average costs in that DPP process in the past processes that could go in the $100,000 to $500,000 per megawatt of install.
Up to $44 million.
Yeah. So that's a big thing.
That's a big range.
Yeah.
And realistically, it would be $250,000. Is that unpredictable?
So one of the big things, you pegged it kind of in this group study that everyone has, and so depending who else is in your group and studying how big it is, you may have some large base investments that are needed that look like MVP-type projects that you'd be responsible for paying. So that's why there's that wide variety. If you're with a big group and there's really no incremental transmission on the system, but you've got all this wind and solar you're getting studied with, you're going to help pay their costs.
But just to be clear, Alan, you're just saying that's what this could be. Now, Heskett 4, we've got known, the project estimate is the project estimate.
Yes.
I just want to make sure you're not thinking this is incremental to that.
No.
No.
Okay.
No, because you...
Yeah, I was just trying to point out in these slides that by putting Heskett 4 in, we're obtaining the cost savings from avoiding that exposure, that risk.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Thank you.
I'm just more curious on what MISO would hit a greenfield project up.
Yeah. Well, that range is the average that was applied to those units that got interconnects during that last process, right, Darcy? So, let's see here. So, yeah, we've made application, and just this week, had our kickoff meeting for that replacement process, and if it doesn't require additional studies, we could actually have a result in December of this year for that. Last slide I have is just some milestones for how Heskett 4 would progress. This year we just applied for those MISO interconnects. We're working on starting the permitting. We would start engineering work in early 2021. Detailed design being completed later in 2021. Start construction in March 2022, and then commercial in early 2023. I apologize, some of these are not chronological. I don't know how that happened. So that's all I have. Any questions that I can answer on that?
Do all your states do ADPs?
No. North Dakota would be the only filing of an ADP that we would make.
And so when in that line would you expect to file for an ADP and expect
to... That's a great segue.
Yeah.
You want to move to the last slide?
Okay. I'm guessing...
Thank you for the setup.
Glad to help you out. I'm guessing this fall.
So... From what we discussed today, what does that mean in terms of filings that you'll see before you hear in 2019? Well, there's particularly two filings. The first one will be by the end of August, file an advanced determination of prudence acceptance here in North Dakota. So we want to, for Heskett 4, so we want to make that filing here in August, by the end of August, for Heskett 4. So you'll see that here yet this fall. And then the second filing that we'll be making will be to request authority to defer and move the remaining plant balances in both Heskett and Lewis and Clark from plant in service over to a regulatory asset. And that is really prescribed by GAAP accounting. So there's no rate changes or anything like that associated with that. It's just that, being that those assets have announced retirement, we need to move them out of plant in service. So in order to be able to do that, to move it to regulatory asset, we need then to make that filing and request that authority. And we'll be making that request then in North Dakota, in South Dakota, in Montana, all in the same time period. So they will all have to adjudicate that particular request, all three jurisdictions.
I'm sure I've known this in the past, but I just am drawing a blank. The other states, do they not have an ADP process at all, or is this under a threshold?
They don't have an ADP process.
Do you like the ADP process?
Certainly, we do, because it provides surety, especially in terms of, we talked before about financing projects. That really is...
That carry weight when
that carries a lot of weight internet? With investors. Yes, it does.
Yeah. And take all the responsibility.
North Dakota's allocation, as you probably know, on the integrated system is around 70%. So that ADP in the state of North Dakota, like Garrett just said, does certainly help, because they know that 70% of that is coming from this state. Yep.
So what does that mean as we look farther out then, right? So we're evaluating, when would we come back in to request, you know, a rate increase, rate decrease, whatever the case may be. What we're doing right now is we're updating our 2020 five-year capital budget, as well as our financial forecast, and we're evaluating that. We know that the company continues to make ongoing investments, right? So we'll need to seek recovery on ongoing investments. But we also know that there will be cost savings once we retire those plants. There will be cost savings that will help offset future increases as well. And in addition, we'll be filing to recover then the remaining plant balances. You know, in Travis's analysis, we set a 15-year amortization of the remaining plant balances in Heskett, Lewis, and Clark. There will have to be some sort of filing made for that request as well. So there's like three different components to what we're evaluating and what would be the best means then in terms of recovering ongoing investments, recognizing that there's offsetting decreases as a result of those plant closures in addition then to recovering the remaining balances. And we're studying that right now. Mm-hmm. And once we've made a determination of a path forward, we'd be back in front of you to present our plan.
What's a challenging aspect? What generation of ratepayer for the early retirements? But then if there's a benefit on the...
And the immediate need, again, is that ADP and then that deferred accounting order. That's immediate needs. So, defer and move the remaining plan balances as well as defer then the packages that we're paying the employees as well. I think.
Yeah, essentially, you know, as Garrett said, we've got a lot of moving parts here, and I think on a positive note, that there's a lot of regulatory mechanisms that we can use to move forward too, right? We've got the rider mechanisms on the generation side, transmission side. We've got the savings we know this is generating. We've got the incremental investment outside of this decision. So we're trying to put all that together, look at what our 5-year is telling us, and then make an informed decision in terms of how to best move forward.
So you have currently 71 employees going down to 11, if I remember correctly, so a difference of 60. Do you have any estimate on how many would be transitioned into new roles within the company or how many would just simply be out of the job? I'm just, and I realize it's...
What we're, I guess I can't give you a
right.
exact answer there, but what we're doing is at each of the facilities, since there's a staggered end date, we're trying to go a year out, I guess, you know, or a year in advance of the retirement dates, and put together a projection of what positions are going to open up within the company, and then let those people apply for those jobs and hold those positions open until the employees are able to move.
Could you say how many are eligible for retirement or would be in that retirement?
There's a certain number that we expect will retire. We hope to be able to find spots for the rest of them. You know, also, as is happening right now, we have folks that are leaving and we're replacing them with temporary folks that know that this is a temporary job. They know there's a limited timeline when they sign up. So those folks all, you know, can apply for other jobs, but there's not a guarantee or a program for them to get on the, I guess, the deferred starting date program. But as far as a number that we foresee right now, we haven't got that put together yet.
Yeah, I would just say at a very high level, like Jay said, we've got 71 employees today. We believe we'll have 11/12-ish positions remaining. And then so you start with 71, take those 12 out, and then of the remaining, we do believe it's around a dozen that have announced their retirement at the end of the poll, right? Oh. So they would, you know, retire out of the company. So that's another segment of that 71. And then those remaining, as Jay alluded to, what we've been doing is working with them on the deferred job award program. But as he mentioned, we're really not going to release that until about a year before each of the retirement dates. So we're working on that. We're working with them on, you know, career development. And we've had one-on-one meetings. HR is meeting with each person that wants to on a one-on-one basis to talk about what their future may be within the company, how we could train them for a potential job within the company. And so there's a number of different HR initiatives going on with that remaining bucket then that isn't either going to have one of those 11, 12 jobs or isn't one of the retirees.
Yeah, realistically, this is a long runway to work with.
Right.
It's going to, not that to demonize what employees may be feeling about ultimately you know, down the road
there's
not having
time.
The job. But there's time. It's going to be more challenging, frankly, on your end to keep fully staffed as you move forward. I would think that'd be a challenge.
Excuse me, I have to leave now to make an 11:30.
Okay. All right. That's all we had, so.
Well, now's a great time, or in about 30 seconds, to talk about Randy and Julie.
Yeah.
What they've done to make us so.
Yeah. Actually, on a
all right, thank you.
You've concerned the fishing community. I just want to let you know in terms of my daughter loves to fish, and she said, Dad, I'm going to lose my winter fishing spot. Don't let them do it. And I said, I can't really factor that in. Right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate
your time. Yep. Thank you.